Okay, today is August 31st, 2015. This is the first interview with William Provis. Is that how you say your last name?
Actually, it's Provis.
Provis.
Okay. A little aside, it does not follow English phonetic rules, even though it's an English name. It was the pseudonym of the convict in Dickens' Great Expectations.
Okay.
Although I think almost everybody in England would say Provis, because English phonetic rules would dictate that.
Mm-hmm.
The long vowel at the end of a syllable. But for whatever reason, my dad said Provis, and ultimately made me conclude that possibly our name was a shortened Slavic name in England, where supposedly we originated it, and that's why the pronunciation came through from there, because that's where his dad was born, was in England.
So. Mm-hmm. So this is the first session. And my name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Specifically, we're going to ask some textual questions, but the base of what we're going to be talking about is you go by Bill, right?
Yeah.
Bill's time on campus from September of 67 through 1972. So, Bill, as I said before we turned on the recorder, I would like you to help us test, even though you just sort of did with that discussion there, but if you could say your name and spell your last name.
Well, I'm William H. Provis, Jr., and Provis, P as in Paul, R O V as in Victor, I S as in Sam. Something I picked up from my dad.
Thank you. And our first question, as I said before we turned the recorder on, was I'm going to ask you this very broad question, could be broad, I guess, about why you chose to attend UW-Madison.
Technically, I didn't. Well, initially, it was among the choices, and actually, I think there were only two. I actually, supposedly anyway, wanted to go to Harvard and had a pretty decent interview for that, but my SATs and stuff just, wouldn't work out. So I wasn't unhappy about going to the University of Wisconsin. My brother was already going. It was a good second choice, better for the parents, cheaper in-state at the time. Of course, I was born and raised in Chicago, but all my high school and college and graduate school years were in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm.
So, you said your brother had gone to school, or was going to school here. So I assume that means you had spent time on campus before you matriculated here.
Yeah, actually, it's October of 1966, Parents' Day, which usually is associated with a football game, right? My parents were supposed to come, that is, my dad and mom, but mother was sick, so I got dragged along. I got to see a tie between Northwestern and Wisconsin, a 3-3 tie. Jeez, I remember that. I remember being at Carson Gully Commons for the first time, and I wasn't there again for a few years until I moved to Lakeshore. I can't remember what I had for lunch. But for dinner, I had one of these things that I've never had since and will never have again. But I took it, I guess, because it was there. It looked good, but then it turned out to be liver. Mm. And, I forced myself to eat it because I was the idiot that took it. things that you remember, anyway.
Right.
I know Carson Gully didn't change too much over the years in comparison to when I was there in 66, I don't think. But it's a very foggy memory that I have of that.
Mm-hmm. So you wanted to go to Harvard. I assume that means that college was something that was important to you as you were growing up and going to school.
Yeah, I think it's things my parents instilled in us. My dad actually finally, after a number of years, got his degree actually in chemical engineering, although he was always considered a metallurgical engineer. But there were, up through the early 60s at least, I don't think there were any actual degrees in metallurgical. Mm-hmm. I think later there were. But in 61, he got his degree from the Illinois Institute of Technology. And he considered it important, I guess. There he is in his 30s, going into his late 30s and looking for becoming a professional, which brought us up to Wisconsin, actually, when he finally got his first professional job and left International Harvester to go to work for Modern Equipment Company in 1963. That brought us to Wisconsin just after I graduated from eighth grade. My brother had spent a year of high school in Finger High School in Chicago. Still a well-recognized high school there, but not necessarily a great one. So we moved to Port Washington, where Modern Equipment Company was. Smith Brothers, the stupid Smith Brothers sign is still there, and there is no Smith Brothers. And in that building now, there's a Duluth, you know, mm-hmm. trading company thing. Mm. At least it's something, but to look at that sign and see that sign.
So Port Washington?
Port Washington, yeah.
Or Port Wisconsin, I'm sorry. Port Washington, Wisconsin. Gotcha.
Right. All right. 30 miles north of Milwaukee.
Right, I think we talked about this last time right. we were.
Port Washington Pirates.
Right.
Where Josh Gasser came
yeah,
from.
Yeah, that's right.
The most notable basketball player of, I think, out of that city. I can't think of anyone else that would have quite his fame. But mm-hmm.
So this doesn't have, well, it may not have anything to do with your time in Wisconsin, but I'm wondering about the transition for you as a freshman in high school from Chicago to Port Washington.
It was initially, I think, a little difficult, but it didn't turn out too bad. I think it took me a little while, I think a few months, to begin to really make friends, you know, to feel more comfortable. I missed all my eighth grade buddies, you know, who, one of whom I just met with Saturday, lives in Madison. I didn't know it until recently. So, in fact, I'm not really up at all with those guys much anymore.
So as you were going through high school and getting ready to go to college, did you have a career path or a major in mind before you got to Madison?
I think I was thinking in terms, which ultimately was a mistake, but then again, at the same time, I still, if I would have applied myself better, but you know, more science math initially, if I applied myself, I might have still been in those areas. I couldn't do it. There was something entirely different when I got to the university about things. I mean, when calculus became applied, say, for example, to chemistry, I was feeling a bit lost. And I was actually having a difficult time with calculus that I shouldn't have had, but I was too used to sitting around in class absorbing rather than reading the text, mm-hmm. and being good enough to do that, to know stuff, and you couldn't do that at the university. You had to apply yourself a little more to the text, I think, and it took me a while to really get the swing of things, I think, with calculus in the first semester, but unfortunately, the second semester, I had one of the smartest profs, I don't know what his name is, on campus, and he was getting us into matrices and dimensions and things like this, and, you know, things beyond where we were supposed to be in calculus. And I was still in honors calculus, but I was having a heck of a time. So that by third semester, I was pretty much lost, and then I had to make a decision. And I became an English major.
So calculus was first and second semester of freshman year?
Yeah, plus there's a third semester of calculus, or at least at the right. time there were three semesters. And by the end of that, I couldn't handle that anymore, and I couldn't really handle the sciences then without really being good, well based in math. I think by that time I realized I wasn't prepared to be a science math type guy.
Mm-hmm. Calculus seems pretty heady stuff for a freshman to take.
You have to take it. In fact, now, of course, they teach, I believe, they're doing calc in high school in last year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had advanced algebraic, mm-hmm. is what it was called in my in my last year at Cornell Washington. And it didn't actually get us into calc yet. But calculus, it's that concept of limits and things like that that was somewhat difficult to adjust to. And it's a different view of math. I think it's such a different view of math as I, you know, going back to remember it. You know, it's not like standard positive and negative integers and things. There's so much more to it, so much more involved, and so much more leading you up to the theoretical nature of math, which was important for the sciences like astronomy and, you know, stuff like that. And I never, unfortunately, adjusted to that. I just couldn't pick it up.
Mm.
But math never left me, you know. I mean, it led me that having some kind of sense of math, I was able to do things when I was a substitute teacher for a while, substituting in math, mm-hmm. classes,
mm-hmm.
Going over theorems that I remembered and stuff like that from high school. But it's also, there's a pedantic nature to mathematics, that if you like numbers, which I still do, relates to things like computers. So that even though I tried computer science for a while, for like moments, after I stopped being a school librarian, I just didn't think I fit there. Or, you know, computer, actually it was business computer related stuff. And I looked at the people around that were there and I said, I don't belong here. This isn't what, you know, whatever. But then some years later, when I'm back, you know, being a librarian, I'm working for Chicago Public Library downtown. That's when computers were really important, you know, in the early to mid-90s. That's when it became significant and where the mathematical nature that was somewhere up here was important to me to be able to deal with it. But I learned D-based programming. Mm-hmm. I taught myself D-based programming, at least enough so that I could, you know, deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was bouncing off our computer guy in our department, our social science department, to be able to do certain things with D-base to create databases, to create something that was quickly searchable.
So this has started to get us in. This talk about calculus started to get us here on campus.
Yes.
So, I'd like to ask your memories if you have any about you know, those first few days on campus.
Another sense of where I went wrong. I came to Og, old Og, of course, in about a week before the school actually opened, as early as I could get in or whatever. I met our house president right away, Dan Horton, but it was like, oh man, we're drunk every night, you know, go out and drink beer and stuff like that. And I always thought after that I wasn't having such a good time understanding what I was doing in class, you know, that I should have done that because it had affected my brain. there was always this thing, I destroyed my brain, and it's all my fault for drinking too much. it's something of a tradition with Wisconsin people. So that was something I always kind of blamed myself for this poor behavior, for not being as good as of a student, But looking at the way I am and or was, you know, I kind of, I can't apply myself unless I really love what it is. And I have to think that looking back at this, I wasn't loving my stuff, you know, which is in part related to why I really failed to be a math science guy. Strangely enough, so we're looking at like a few months in, and I just totally broke up. Down. You know, I'm talking to my parents, and, you know, one of those things. The adjustment that kids go through, right? You're away from home for a serious amount of time for the first time in your life. And, you know, I was upset. And so what I found humorous is that I got talked into staying into school, of course, which I did, by my brother, my uncle, my late uncle, my late father. And within the space of a few weeks, my brother was supposed to be a sophomore anyway, and actually wasn't. He was doing too many social things and things like that. He dropped out. And he ultimately joined the Air Force and didn't come back to college for 3.5 years, came back to the U, and did graduate, of course, from there. But, you know, I felt traitored. I mean, you can understand that. I'm being told, hey, you know. But anyway, some things, those things that you do on Sundays, you're in the dorms. The way the dorms were organized was, you know, your meal structure, Gordon Commons, which, of course, doesn't exist in the same form anymore either. It was kind of a cool thing. They had nice breakfast, but almost nobody ever went to breakfast. But so you had breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But on Sunday, you had breakfast and a big lunch or something. And, you know, dinner, you're on your own. So you'd get 20 meals a week. So, you know, it was Sunday night, you'd usually go out places, you know, stuff like that. Of course, this year, it's interesting. We know we had the first sit-down McDonald's in the country a few years after I started at the U, where the post office is on Lake Street. But there was a place called Burger Chef that I used to go to that I liked from the time I was a kid that doesn't exist. Burger Chef kind of was doing a lot of the same things that Burger King did, you know, open flame broil. Mm-hmm. And they were like on Johnson Street. I actually have some info in my Gmail as to the specific address that we would go to it, you know, street that's entirely different. And that was the first sit-down fast food place of that type that I'd ever been to, you know. And may have been, like, the first sit-down of its type. Some years later on State Street, they had a larger sit-down venue about where one of the museum, I think the Museum of Modern Art is, approximately had the address for them, too. In my Gmail, stuff that I asked, I went to ask a librarian, Madison Public, asking about the addresses. So, could you check the phone books for this? And of course, one of the distinct things about campus at that time was Renovabs. I'm sure you've heard this. And of course, I distinctly remember Renovabs on the corner of Park and University. And my brother said, no, there's a bank there. Well, I don't know. Renovabs, actually, that Renovabs, well, and the Renovabs where Walgreens is now on State Street, right near us, or right near Memorial Library, were fairly sizable and distinct and would mean something more, I think, to students or something than a bank. Which I guess was First Wisconsin. But in verifying the addresses, First Wisconsin had to be almost directly on the corner, but Renovabs took up most of the space. And then next to Renovabs was a Spudnuts donut place, which I thought had been destroyed, or I thought in the early, you know, 1970 being a significant year of unrest, where a lot of things were occurring early in the year, and of course reading over stuff that David worked on, you know, broken windows, all that kind of stuff. I thought the Spudnuts had a, like, a car. I had heard something like a car or something drove into the Spudnuts and, you know, destroyed it or whatever. They couldn't find anything on that at Madison Public. So I must have been totally wrong. It must have been one of those apocryphal type stories.
Right.
Spudnuts did have its windows damaged, according to one thing that they found, and at that address, I believe, in May or something around the Kent State.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So can we talk about registration? Because registration in 1967, probably throughout your whole time, was completely different.
Yeah, what you did, I mean, things are computerized, but it's computerized for people that aren't dealing with computers, that is, students aren't dealing with computers. You had to run to different buildings to do. And I do remember that routine almost every semester, but I think it's blocked. I think it's one of those things, because it's an excruciatingly painful sort of issue that you have to go through to get your classes selected, your timing, and all that kind of stuff. It's just like, man, let's forget this. Afterwards, you know, you asking the question, actually, it's one of the first times I've ever thought about it. I think it's just something I don't want to think about. You know, it's not as you got to do this stuff to be able to get your classes selected and your timing and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. You know, I got to select the right classes and everything. Mm-hmm. But it was a painful thing, and you're doing a lot of running around, you know, to do that. So.
Do you remember coming out here to the Stock Pavilion?
Not offhand, no.
Okay.
Probably some of the things that I remember, because this is the area, of course, then where Ag was originally, where the U developed, I guess, originally is down in this area. Mm-hmm. One of my distinct memories is around where... I'm going to say maybe this curved corner here or something, there was like a barn or something, and I saw a cow once, you know, right? And I touched it. I touched the cow. It was right next to the fence. And then I realized why that wasn't a good idea. Cows don't take baths. But anyway, those are about my only remembers, the egg area.
Sure. So then, let's back up. You talked about getting to Og Hall as soon as you were able, and joining in the...
Part of that, by the way, was related, I think, to the stuff that my brother was doing that he got himself involved in that led to his downfall. But anyway.
So you got to Og Hall. Were you going out to have beers, or was it...
Right, no, I don't think it, I don't, you know, liquor in the dorms, which, of course, you weren't supposed to do that, I can't remember us really ever having much in the dorm, sneaking anything in the dorm, stuff like that. I think, you know, you go to Paisans, have a beer, you know, you go to other places, have a beer, you know, stuff like that. Paisans at the time was right across the street from so that was always a quick place to go for Sunday night dinners, nice lasagna, you know, stuff like that. The lasagna is still pretty good. I love their Garibaldi sandwiches. That was a distinct memory. And I think in Wisconsin not too long ago, they were asking about food around, and my name got mentioned. Like, I was talking about the Garibaldi, still good, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the part that they recorded.
Mm-hmm. So, registered, taking classes. We know that calculus is one of your classes, but are you also taking sort of heavy math and science?
Well, chemistry, and here. Let's make this easier for me. Remember what I'm taking. Here we go. Here's the complete, you know, whatever. So the first semester, I general chem, freshman English, calculus and analytic geometry. ROTC orientation. Mm-hmm. Have you asked about that in the past?
You know, I have, but I haven't asked everybody about that in the past. Why don't we, if you don't mind, talking about that for a minute or two?
I don't. You know, it was one of those things you kind of wanted to avoid because they forced you to go to it way early in the morning, right? And it was the lingering thing. I mean, I discovered, I think, at some time during my education here at the U, why did this exist? And, you know, that we're a land-grant college. And all the land-grant colleges had, originally it was, you had to take ROTC. You actually had to take it. But eventually, because of, you know, senses of freedom in college, you know, whatever the heck it is, it was, okay, you had to do the orientation. You didn't necessarily actually have to be in it. So, you know, it's ROTC orientation for which you didn't get a grade, but you had to be up early to sit through it. And I don't know, it only lasted a few weeks, I think.
Okay.
Something like that, but it was like, I'm thinking 7:30 in the morning, you know, and okay. You know, students, we like to go out and drink and stuff like that. Who wants to be out there? You know, so there you go. And, oh yeah, phi ed, actually, it seems to me that, I was required for a semester, and it may be listed here, but I didn't actually have it. Hmm. I didn't have it until the second semester, something like that. You had to have one semester of this, I believe. I believe it was only one semester, and I did this cop-out that a lot of students did then in the second semester. Oh, I don't know how to swim. So you didn't go through the routine of, you know, bouncing around, jumping around, and over-exercising yourself and all that kind of stuff. You got to swim, which was fun, because we were swimming at the Nat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Nat was new then, and that's where we were doing. Well, actually, we were doing all our phi there, I guess. So,
so you were able to tell them you could swim. So then
I could tell them I couldn't swim.
Okay.
A lot of kids would say, "Oh, I can't swim," so they'd put you in swimming all semester.
Oh, to help sort of teach you how to swim.
Teach you how to swim.
But you already knew.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I still can't swim that great, you know, but I could swim, but, you know.
Okay.
But it was one of those things. Kids latch on to this stuff, and, you know, it's a way to get out of the heady phi ed that you didn't like, you know.
Mm.
You're running around and doing this and stuff like that is that you didn't want to do. But like I said, I believed, you know, my memory is it was the next semester.
Okay.
It's related to certain things that occurred that related to how I got out of the draft. Also, because it would be second semester, I'm already, like, I'm weighing in the 220s or something. When I came to college, I was in the 190s. So, you know, it's that dorm food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh man, I gotta grab everything. It's, you know, I'm gonna have seconds of it. It's like you never ate before.
Right.
You know, that kind of stuff that unfortunately I ran my life that way. I love smorgasbords and things like that. Now in my life, I find it in many cases repellent to go to a smorgasbord because, I mean, I still like them, but what's the point? You know, I can't get what I want. There's too many things.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's better to go to a restaurant, select something.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, if you're going to go to a schmort, pick a few things. And then not an attitude that I had as a student, unfortunately. I just, you know, grab lots of stuff. Drink a lot of the Kool-Aid that we call, of course, called bug juice. you know, eat a lot of the desserts. One of the first places I think I saw apple pie with cheese on it. Mm. Pieces of apple pie with cheese. And my brother tells me my dad used to like this and eat this, and I don't remember it. You know, cheese on apple pie, it just wasn't in my... I thought, God, weird. But it actually is. So,
I want to get back to... You talked about how... you know, it was second semester phi ed because it was related to how you got out of the draft.
was related to that, or related in part, it's just related to, that first semester as a freshman, I'm beginning to gain weight and not following it. But by second semester, I know I've gained a lot of weight because they forced us to get weighed. And why it relates to the draft is a few years later, I'm out of draft in relationship to that weight, which is still more.
Okay.
But we'll get it. We can get into that one later because that's a little bit later.
Okay. So one thing I want to know about this time period, this first semester, your first semester here coincides with the Dow riot.
The second Dow riot, as it turned out. I thought I missed any Dow riots. I thought the big Dow riot was 1966, but it was the first. And I believe that was, from what I was reading about, it's like the first one where, we're calling out the, gassing and stuff like that. The second one, no, I didn't have any participation in. What I think I remember about that specific time, though, when it happened, I'm going back, but I didn't remember that there was a riot in October of 67, was that some guys showed up who I think were related to, a striking Dow or something like that, talking about stuff. And I remember saying, well, I'm not into this so much, but I'm a conservative socialist. I remember using that specific, like I really understood what I was saying. That much is one of the things I remember. I wasn't in that first and second semester, I think, doing any kind of marching. Well, there wasn't so much going on beyond the Dow thing, I think, that year. Things didn't begin to occur until my sophomore year, I think, mm-hmm. that I got more involved in.
So is there anything in that first year from your memories and from, the sort of the reflecting that you've been doing since you knew this was coming that you want to talk about?
Nothing I can think of about that first year. All I can think of the year is that it's a struggle. It's an academic struggle. And, of course, one of the things, the determinative things for me is because I wasn't applying myself as a student, and I actually didn't realize I never really had. That I couldn't handle a superior amount of credits. Something that went beyond like four courses a semester was difficult for me. And yet, if you're going to do your routine graduating in 4 years, you generally would need to average about four courses a semester to get your 120 credits. Well, I ended up in summer schools doing that. It was just too much for me. Too many books, too many this. And especially as I got into English. English just freaked me out. I love reading stuff, but you're going to give me 17 books? Man, mm-hmm. And it's funny to think of. Here, I've been retired for 6.5 years, whatever, and I've read 900 books during retirement, far more than I had been reading before. But I got more time for it, say, or I just took the time out. I could have read more than I did, but I started a reading list in 1995, and it reached the 300s when I retired in 2009. I mean, that's okay, average about 60 a year, but I was doing better, or 50 or maybe. But since I retired, I realized I could read, but of course, it's not the same kind of reading as forcing yourself to read all these esoteric English lit books or books in other courses that are science courses. Well, at least in science courses, you didn't have to read much more than the text, which was a problematic as it was anyway. But of course, I didn't get into that stuff that much. I mean, we were doing freshman English was like composition, where that's one thing I remember. It forced you to write stuff, and that was difficult. I'm still not. I don't consider myself a very great writer, and I can't sit down and, and do what you need to do. I'd love to write some novels, short stories, something like that, but I also understand writing. from the standpoint of what it takes. And it takes, again, this kind of, you know, that, I'm not going to put it in. I like to create things just more instantaneously. But then I don't always follow up on it, which has always been one of my bigger problems. But, doing composition as freshman English, sometimes I felt really cool when I could think of something to do a kind of composition about. You know, one of the compositions we were supposed to do was related to a definition of something, I think. We were supposed to work on a definition and one of our guys kept using this word tedium, referring to a lot of things. So I finally struck me, I got something to work on, something to write a composition on, so I could take this word tedium, and I don't think I got a very good grade on it, but still it was some way that I could fill out an assignment that was pleasing, too. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, school is often full of stuff that's not pleasing. You know, assignments that are not pleasing because you don't feel they're going to instruct you, or you don't have any sense of enjoyment on picking out a topic to work on. Always the problem is it's like work. Mm-hmm. You know, you like a job that you like doing. All right, not many people actually get that.
All right, let's move forward then to year two, and let's start off by asking just the question, did you return to Aga Hall?
Oh, yeah. That first year I almost killed my first roommate, Art Tatum. I remember getting his name and starting to look up the name Tatum before I came to Aga, and I found... Art Tatum related music, African American guys, you know, like that. I didn't think that was him. I found Tatum's related, and Edward Tatum, I think, that got a Nobel Prize. That was him. That was Art's. Hmm. Some of Art's relatives, and he's in the sciences now. There's just something. Art annoyed me, and I got angry at him and almost, you know, killed him once. Right, you're just like so. We decided not to be roommates. So I got a new roommate, Steve Katz, in the second semester, and he was my roommate second year. And we got along pretty well, so that's always a good thing.
Mm-hmm. So new roommate for year two in Aga Hall.
Technically, we're still, but my longest term roommate probably was Steve. Yeah.
And the start of sophomore year, you still are sort of, or you
I'm
are
still floundering.
You're grappling.
Yeah, because
like.
The start of, well, of course, I went to summer school prior to that and took contemporary lit in Introduction to History of Science. Oh, man. I thought I was going to do decent at that. Well, I did get B's and stuff. But anyway, yeah, I only had, I had three courses in my first semester sophomore. It's my last semester of calc. And I took general physics. I didn't do too good in that either. General physics. Oh, yeah, because chem was only first semester. Okay. So I started physics in the second semester and my third semester. I was finishing physics and, you know, just not catch on. Stuff that I was generally good at in high school, I just wasn't getting. I wasn't catching on in college. But I also started by the American history stuff, and that was interesting to me. That got me leaning in a different direction. I don't think I did that great. Oh, I did get an A in second semester American history. Wow. First semester, I got a B. Yeah. It's something I think that's related to what led me to then more humanities than... science. I would have to do humanities because it was something I could understand. Because I just wasn't understanding the sciences. I wasn't understanding the math. It was just extraordinarily philosophical in many ways, or extraordinarily off the beam now, you know, I couldn't lock on to physical concepts that I was used to having structure. Mm-hmm. The structure of these things was gone, mm-hmm. because actually, that's the way it was supposed to be. I didn't, you know, stuff I realize now, later in my life, or years ago, that the sciences and math science wasn't as straightforward as I thought it was. It wasn't as well defined, as well structured. There's a lot of things going on here that are related to your ability to understand how to deal with it. I think it's all part of the reason humanity seemed much easier. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Even though there's not necessarily a structure to it.
So, but at this point, you haven't officially sort of jumped ship from the sciences and moved to the humanities.
Well, by the end of the third semester, I pretty much have. Okay. I had started out. I did take a meteorology course. One of those. All the kids were saying, this is an easy one to take that. You know, still needed some more science or something, so I took survey. And I still got a C. You know? Man. Just something about it I didn't quite catch on to good enough. But by then, I was done with the sciences. So mm-hmm. It was generally history and literature from then on. I had an intro to psych in later. I started out in it. I guess I didn't finish it. The second semester of the 69-70 year. Yeah. I did do an introduction to psych. But everything that I'm looking at here is really... And then I, you know, went into education later. That's why my graduation isn't until December of 72, because mm-hmm. I added all that stuff later so that there was other credits. And I actually dropped out once, of course, doing the 69-70 year, I dropped out. But, you know, by then I was pretty much, you know, then it's all history and English.
Okay. And you had said, you had alluded to the fact that the second year, you either started to take more of an interest or maybe participated in some of the things that were going on.
Things were happening. In the second year, the Black Studies strike, we call it that, or we call it now. I guess we'd say African American Studies strike, whatever. But that occurred then. That's my first experience with the National Guard and with being gassed, which was semi unintentional, I think. But I remember marching around for it and being like downwind when they started setting off gas and getting that. But I did feel that, you know, I did have an inclination, you know, that this was fair to African American students, that we needed to be doing something for them. But I wasn't like a big shaker and mover on this. I just, you know, I always felt more, well, thinking back on it, more of a fringe kind of guy, you know, more of a participant, but not a leader. You know, not a guy who would get up and speak and say anything or mm-hmm. you know, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And while I didn't agree, say, with the SDS necessarily, you know, I didn't agree with these things that led to a destruction, violence, or whatever, for whatever reason. I felt that I understood it, but, you know, my sense, I think then and my now, continues to be, if we're going to march, it should be peace. It should be peaceful. Like, you know, the Million Man March or whatever, you know, the March on Washington in 63 or something like that. Marches mm-hmm. should be like that. Nothing happened in these marches. I mean, ideas got passed on. People's lives changed because of these things, but not because of violence. I never felt that was the route to go. But I felt that I understood it because I felt that I understood the sense of oppression that might lead to violence, especially for African Americans. You know, we still in many cases are dealing with a racist society. We can't put things together, but at the same time, you know, I've gone in a slightly different direction and look at things like Ferguson. Okay, honestly, look at the scientific evidence of what it is that you have in front of you, and don't automatically say that this was a racial thing, that because it was black, that's why it got shot. I think that in some cases that's become too automatic. There are racial problems that we have, and we have to address them, and we have to address them properly, but it's not by either side saying that this is the absolute. I'm oppressed because this always happens. No, you're oppressed because you feel oppressed, and because in too many cases it happens. We can't disagree with it, but in many cases it does not happen. What you're thinking is not happening. You have to free your mind and, you know, look at all the signs. Well, that was what was part of our education. I think of my education and things I think that I picked up slowly maturing in those second, third, and fourth years, you have to maintain a sense of open-mindedness about everything. You can't always be a right-winger or a left-winger.
So, Bill, before we wrap up this session, we're, as you can tell, we're sort of going through here sort of chronologically. So this second year, this sophomore year, anything else stand out that you want to discuss?
Well, Ag Hall was an interesting thing. I don't know how much people have talked about Ag Hall. There was a fire in Ag Hall that I've been trying to identify, timing. And it could have been the spring semester of 67, 68. It could have been the spring semester of 68, 69, but I don't think so. I think it was probably the spring semester of 67, 68, but I'm not positive. Burned up a bunch of carpeting on maybe 7th floor, 11th floor, or whatever it is. Clear dog Ag West, because it occurred at Ag West. I'm not sure if it did anything at all to East. And just, you know, one of those things I've been trying to track down. Well, I mean, interesting features of Ag, you know. Now, I guess, ultimately, a lot of people conclude that it's, you know, student slum. Or was, or something like that. High-rise slum. You know, that kind of thing is, I guess, in essence, was the thinking of this apparently put together too fast residence hall, which I didn't realize that there was a lot of that kind of thinking about it, or it being a high-rise slum thinking or anything like that. There's a single door, of course, well, for all dorm rooms, really, just a single door. And there's a window. And what was traditional at certain times is that you open that door and you had your windows open, you know, everything's flowing out to the windows. It's the lack of pressure adjustment in places like that. Another reason that they shouldn't exist that way. We need to have like things in the doors, you know, holes in the doors or something like that to control those kinds of issues, I think. But maybe related or unrelated, I don't know. The Mifflin Street riot, the first block party, apparently, I believe, was that in that spring semester of my sophomore year. And my memory, of course, is that when it occurred, I was in my room studying something, and the windows were open, and the gas that they shot floated up from there to Ag. And I was being at least semi-gassed by that. It was maybe semi-humorous, maybe not so humorous, but something I remember about that year. You know, it's all part of the normal circumstances of things during that time.
All right. Well, let's wrap up for now. And as I said, we may get back to this afternoon. But this concludes the first session with Bill. And help me with your name again.
Pravis. Yeah.
William Pravis.
Short, just think short O.
All right, this is the second session with Bill Provis. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program, and today is August 31st, 2015. So when we last left, we were at the end of the spring of 1969. You talked a little bit about the Mifflin Block Party, so now that takes us to the summer of 69.
Yeah. I was at summer school in 69. Summer schools I don't remember too much, to tell you the truth. And like I said, I was going to all these summer schools because I couldn't seem to handle, 15 credits a semester. Hard to do. Like I say, I have a tendency, I don't remember too much what summer school, although that summer, the summer of 69, I was taking Black Literature in Modern America, which was my, I think I had another American literature course, but I don't see it, or stuff that relates to it. That got me introduced to Richard Wright and Ralph Ellis. Mm-hmm. God, remember, and I just found it interesting because while in reading Richard Wright's main book, Native Son, I was always disappointed that the major character was a murderer, but it's something, it's influenced, it's like unintentional murder, but at the same time, it was just an odd thing. But of course, it's a well-written piece, and it took place in Chicago, so I knew that some of the newspaper writing that he was sort of quoting for the related to the character itself and what was going on with the character was from something like the Tribune. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of specifics I don't think were mentioned. It was of some interest. That Invisible Man, was just fascinating because, the concept, you're African-American and you could be invisible. And I can see that, but at the same time, when, of course, we were dealing with even more racist types of issues at the time, almost anything you were doing as an African-American might make you visible, simply because somebody could find some reason to be offended by anything that an African-American did if they opened their mouth or something like that, but it was an interesting concept.
So that summer, were you able to stay in Ogg Hall during the summer, or did you have to find alternate?
Actually, no. The Southeast halls were pretty much, I think, non-choices for summer school. I don't know why. I don't know if anybody actually stayed in them during summer. But, I was generally out at my excursion or whatever. I remember living in and I often got to live alone because it was cheaper in the Lakeshore halls. But generally, I think it was Crossage that we ended up at in summer.
Okay.
But I can't. I think almost every summer it was in Crossage.
So you would only go back to Port Washington to visit in the summer?
In the summer, in intersections. There's always an intersection between summer school and stuff like that, so I'd be living at home during that period of time. Maybe, although, it's only a matter of a few weeks and stuff. Consistently, I was working at the State Historical Society Library. That job I got in 19, it's one of those, you got these lists or cards or whatever with possible jobs, part-time jobs. So that was one of the first that I went to, and I got I was interested and they wanted me, and I didn't screw it up too much, except at one point, but whatever. But I worked there fairly consistently throughout my college career. There's a distinct memory, actually, in my freshman, that spring semester, the freshman year. This is what college is about. You're not in the real world, even though the real world exists. And an ex- example then of that from the spring semester is when Robert Kennedy was assassinated. All right, I got up that morning. I didn't know anything about it. I went to work at the City Historical Society Library, and there were people talking to each other, you know, talking around and stuff like that, and I was doing, you know, whatever, and it was a few hours. And then I make it to the dorm, and I'm up I was on the ninth floor, which was the den floor of the two floors that comprised the house at Ogg. And I was looking in, and I saw, I'm thinking Sandra Van Oker, but that wasn't it, or somebody who was distinct at the time. And all of a sudden, but without knowing for sure, I kind of knew what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, that, you know, Kennedy had been shot, and that, well, he was dead. Or, I mean, just like, I didn't know this as many hours after it had occurred. And then all of a sudden it registered to me what was going on when I was at the historical. So that's what these people, that people were discussing this, and somehow I, you know, I wasn't catching on at all. It was just a weird sort of thing. But anyway, yeah, there's a semi-aside. So, yeah, during intersessions, generally I'd be home for a little bit, but, you know, since I worked at whenever the dorms were available, mm-hmm. I'd be in them.
What kind of work did you do for the State Historical Society?
I was a page, actually. But somewhere, I think in my second year or something like that, I ended up in the microphone room, which used to be, if you're facing the cert desk, at least I don't have this wrong, on the left side, all the stacks on the left, or all the floors, pretty much, were government publications. And in the back on that same floor of that, what was the microfilm reading room at the time. That's all kind of different now. Mm-hmm. But that's where I worked out of then for maybe 2.5 years, something like that. In essence, I was still a page.
Right.
Getting,
you were just getting microfilm.
Yeah, getting microfilm, helping people with microfilm, using the negative printer. You know, the copier that we had for microfilm would produce a negative. So we, in some cases, we actually had negatives of negative microfilm. So it was interesting that you could produce a positive out of that. But if somebody wanted a copy of something out of the New York Times, this might be why you would see a negative somewhere online, was because that was the copy that somebody uploaded or whatever. Because that's what they got, you know, back in the 60s, 70s, mm-hmm. for a long time until that stuff changed. Of course, God, microfilm is so old.
Was there work at the State Historical Society? Did that have any relevance or bearing on you eventually becoming a librarian?
Yeah, actually, it did influence that. Jumping towards the end, of course, the length of my college career extended because I went into secondary ed. But ultimately, I didn't feel that I was doing very good as a teacher, and that I wouldn't be good at that many years later. I would have been, but not then, not when I was going through my methods. So I was then more influenced to pursue grad school in library science, and ended up at UWM because the business didn't accept me. My grade point, you know, like that. I struggled to get the grade point back up, but you really needed to be over 3 or well over, and I needed a little better GREs. I mean, I always like to think that I went to my GRE, I got like an 89, 88, whatever that was. This is so good. But, you know, now you're working with an exclusive set of people, and you're getting a higher GRE general than people that are going on in all sorts of esoteric degrees, so I had to look at it in a different sense. It wasn't that bad. I was better than 88% of the people taking a GRE, and this is a much more exclusive class of people than the people that were taking SATs and ACTs. So.
Right. Okay, so now we're So now we're first semester junior year, or first semester third year, however you want to.
Yeah, I fell in love. Oh God! During the summertime, while the Cubs were beginning to descend, unfortunately, but they were still good for momentarily. But then there was the Mets. Anyway, we took a trip to New York, staying at Tudor City, near the UN building, and mother was doing stuff related to her artwork. She was a professional artist. And we also visited some friends of ours that had lived in Port Washington for a period of time, and the dad had worked at Modern Equipment Company for a bit, but then he went back, I'm thinking it's Westinghouse or something, in Baltimore, and they lived in Catonsville, and we visited there, and the older daughter, who I always kind of liked, I fell in love, I went through trauma throughout the 70s, plus I got sick. Ultimately, my family doctor said that I had scarlet fever. I had strep, something. I was seriously sick then towards the latter part of that semester, and then, a combination of things. I wanted to go to Towson State Teachers College because that's eventually where Mary Jane was going to end up, and so I dropped out. But, well, once again, my parents convinced me to go back to school, and then Mary Jane called it quits with me. And, and then I went through that trauma. So then I was back. The fall semester then was kind of like, oh, my God, I couldn't concentrate anyway. So it was probably just as well that I dropped out. And amazingly enough, I think I came back despite all my internal trauma and anger. And that's where I met the guys that I meet up with more now. The guys that in the dorms, I was then no longer in Ag. I was out at Lakeshore and Trip and in Viola's house. And the guys then that I met there have been the more long-term type, although quite an interruption from the 70s until more recently. But they were guys that still held more meaning to me than anybody that I knew, aside from my roommate, maybe one other guy, Steve Katz that I have for a year and a half, and then one other, Rick Edmonds, who was a buddy of ours, and maybe one other. But there was a greater number of people that held some significance for me, and in some senses I felt like I said this to them more recently that you guys saved me. That's kind of what I felt, developing these friends in the Lakeshore Halls was a much more significant moment for personally, college career wise. Mm-hmm. So it was a great thing to end up at Lakeshore Halls.
So that was the spring of 70?
Yeah, that was spring, 69-70. Yeah.
Right, so the 69-70 year, but spring of 70.
Yeah, so there's a lot of significant things going on then in the spring of 70, but I suppose I should hit the fall of 69. There were distinct things. I was marching around, or I felt like I was marching around more. It seemed like there was march every other day, but the ones, I guess, that I remember mostly, I think, was the Welfare Mothers March, which... Of course, I find later father, James Grappi, who's, noted activist then, had organized. And then the Moratorium Day March. Now, for a long time, I thought this was in November. And there was a Moratorium Day in November, I've done some research or whatever, but I couldn't get anything about what it is that happened that day that I remember here in Madison. So, as it turns out, it was the wrong day. The November was wrong. It had to be from because Madison Public confirmed as a librarian. On the October 15th moratorium day, what I remembered was speeches at the Fieldhouse. Although, like I say, I didn't remember it was October. And then marching from the Fieldhouse out to the square, the Capitol Square. While we were marching, I looked around and said, where were all you people during the Welfare Mothers March? You know, it's like I always say, I had all these liberal things connected together, and I thought they should all be connected together. And within maybe a few years or maybe many years, I realized, no, they weren't really connected at all. They didn't have to be. And that Vietnam ultimately was a much more personal thing for a lot of mothers and fathers who had children my age at in the war, you know, stuff like that. It was a combination of things. So in any case, I remarked that, and we walked to the square. We actually sat on the street for a period of time. I don't know if it was organized exactly when for us to get up, but we definitely got up, and I remember marching back, and I think I was walking down State Street, and a kind of shorter Madison cop had a nightstick in my back, sort of escorting me across the street, not, you know, forcibly, so to speak, not even real firmly, but it was just there. It was just a distinct thing that I remembered. Mm-hmm. I remembered the jacket that I was wearing, which is why I kept thinking, part of the reason I kept thinking it was done, because I was wearing a winter jacket that I, you know, remember as being familiar with. But then I double-checked the weather, and, you know, Madison Public checked the weather, and it was in the 40s or something. So I said, okay, October 15th, okay. Obviously had to be the right day. So that was significant. I had become anti-Vietnam War, and of course I was anti-being drafted. So what happens? Okay, November is significant because, and this I remember, the first draft lottery since World War I, which took in all of us who were up to in the early 30s, and my number was 21. And that would have made me draftable if I didn't have student deferments. Here and then I dropped out, though. You know, whatever. But I wasn't that concerned about it. I mean, you could go back to speed, your student deferment, back, whatever. And of course, I was convinced to go back. I'm in the lecture halls. And then it's 1970, and this is a significant time because we're looking at marching because of the decision on the Chicago 8, 7. Early in the year, when I thought the spud nuts got destroyed, but wasn't apparently. But a lot of things were going on. But at that time, I was beginning to think more. I had to spend time actually in school, you know, actually do things, you know, not avoid classes, you know, stuff like that. The TA strike, and I remember that distinctly. And I note that it was what David and Terry worked up on that thing, that it was in March, April, and that jives with me, but I didn't strike classes, and I think I talked to one TA, I said, you know, I can't do it, you know, I gotta get my classes, so it was a much becoming more student-oriented, even though in some of my later years, like, oh my God, an 11 o'clock class that I never get up for to go to, we went to like 50% of the time or something. But this one year, you know, the kind of things that left me with dreams that I never graduated. Anyway, but I was still much more firmly getting my work done. Getting stuff done and even less active in the fringe, you know, all the, I think, SDS stuff is going on. And then, of course, Kent State happens and really screws things up. And my memories then become of that semester is that I had no finals. Finals were pretty much eliminated. Almost every teacher, except one. Well, one, I had a professor, and that was Major American Poets, I believe. Is that on there? Yeah, Major American Poets, and I always wish I still had the book for that. But, because there's a lot of great poetry. He had a final. An actual final. It was the only final that I actually took, because everything was so screwed up that year, with the TA strike, Kent State, and then earlier in the year, it was just that particular semester was just totally screwy. I do remember something the term pimping you do something nasty to somebody, but it's supposed to be funny, right? Is it? I don't know. But a guy whose name I still can't figure out what guy this was, and I, the door of, this is the night before my final, on the door of this one guy that, it's not that we didn't like, but just something that he wanted to do. We were filling up cans of pop, empty cans of pop with water, leaning them on the door. I could hang around with it when this happened, but, so Eric would end up opening the door and that's not going to fall on top of him, which happened. And he was PO'd it. The guy that was, I was doing it with, he got to hear what happened, but I had to be at the final. Like, here I'm up all night, though, and going to the final, and then after that, this guy had one of these little motorcycles or whatever, and he was riding me around. He rode me to work or something. And as I'm walking down the hallway from out of microfilm, at one point I fall asleep walking. Actually, falling asleep, it was just like a boom, boom, and then I woke up. But that I remember, I went to bed, actually right after dinner, and I slept until like noon the next day or something from, 6 o'clock or whatever, and I think I was actually late for working. I think this was the day, we had the Centrex phones, right? The 262, you dial to, whatever. And I was dialing my buddy Rick, who lives up in Fitchburg, okay? I always consider one of my top friends. I look at it as a best friend still from college. And all of a sudden, there's another person talking on the phone, like we've become a party line or something, and it's my boss. But she wasn't calling me, she was calling somebody else. And then I call back and say, hey, wait a minute, I'm late or something, aren't I? Oh, yeah. Because I've been sleeping so long. Weird things. We got into hi-fi and stuff like that in the dorms. That was a big thing, stereo. My brother was in Greenland. He'd been sent to Greenland as a punishment for screwing up as a weather reporter in Denver, I think it was. He fell asleep. And you got to make these reports hourly. Okay, so they got, because he'd been drinking or something.
Is this the brother in the Air Force?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he became a meteorologist in the Air Force. Air Force here. No flying, none of that kind of stuff. Well, he couldn't. He had glasses. You can't have glasses and fly. And, he wouldn't have cared about that anyway. But, yeah, so I think he enjoyed what he was doing. But they said, well, okay, after this stuff happened, they're going to, do something to him. And, hey, you haven't been overseas. Well, if he got sent to Vietnam, what would he do? He'd be doing weather reports. That would be significant, but he'd never be anywhere where, they didn't send him there. They sent him to Greenland. It gets pretty cold there. Well, but a lot of neat stuff there. There are weather conditions today. It may still exist that way in Thule. If it's below, whatever, you're isolated wherever you're at. You're in rec, there you are. You stay there until the conditions change. You're at work, you stay there until the conditions change. That's the way it was. Plus, well, they got deals, the non, I can't think of the word now, but it's related to taxes and imports and exports and stuff like that, which you could avoid. Mm-hmm. So you could, you know, buy things.
Duty free? Like
that. Yeah, duty free. That's it. Duty free. Duty free stuff. So he got a hold of dust bugs. Dust bugs were those things that you could kind of like attach to tone arms, or maybe it wasn't exactly that. It was actually like a tone arm, a separate tone arm that would scrape along the record and pick up dust while the record's playing, something like that. I remember he got those things. I remember I got into a big argument with him because I was always irritated. It was an insane argument, or you know, our differences, whatever, as to how we are. We still get into arguments, but that was all part of the things about living though. They were that related, of course, because we were interested in stereo equipment. We were interested in, you know, records. We had first started seriously buying records with, God, where do I get my money from, you know, but, you know, dig up money to buy something. And there was a record co-op or something that a place that was like a co-op, and I can't think of what it was, on State Street that developed while we were there, where we would buy records a lot. There was a place down the street, which if I just get to the phone books, you know, I could look up all these places probably. That was a standard that guy had been running it for years, where I would buy records quite often. None of these places exist. Jeez, and haven't existed for years. I remember there was a comics store too. I got into underground comics. The Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers. I found them initially. I think one of the main places that was supposed to show up was in the LA Free Press. And I had, because I was working in microfilm, that's where I actually first ran across these guys. The, you know, the strips or whatever. And I was reading them, instead of doing work. So I find the collected adventures were available. Gilbert Shelton, the author, illustrator of those. And, of course, the Fabulous Freak Brothers were actually not related. I think I found out the first two collected adventures at this one comics place. I just love this stuff. It was representative. What Shelton did was very representative of the time, you know. Things related to the draft. Oh, I'm going to dress up like a woman and go to, you know, whatever. But I'm gay. Oh, but so you can be in General Gaylord's brigade. It was a guy, you know, who looks obviously gay, you know, whatever. One of the Freak Brothers trying to avoid getting drafted or going into the service, you know. It was just, you know, a lot of funny bits. But anyway, those were things that kind of like meant something to me while relating to working at the historical society, and then of course just the times. So the 70s, that spring of 70, I went to summer school though. What was I dating?
So summer of 70?
And summer of 70. And that was significant, of course, because, I was taking intensive English Lit, 1745 to 1798. I think I remember the book for that. And European History, I kind of remember that. But, of course, that's when Sterling Hall was bound. In August, I think I was still, you know, actually taking classes at the time, but I'm positive I was there. I always felt, this was my feeling, my undercurrent, whatever, of what happened then. Right after this, it's like a culmination of what's been going on in 1970, to me, anyway. And, you know, I understand, these guys didn't intend for Fastnacht to get killed, you know, and all but one have served some time for this. We're still the one that hasn't been found, I guess, right? Never showed up. And could be dead, I suppose. And, you know, I sympathize with their aims, I guess, but I didn't sympathize necessarily with what was done and or what happened with the actual bombing. And because of that, I always felt something happened at Madison, something happened across the country in relationship to what was going on campuses, despite Kent State and Maine. Something happened that just, like, cooled it. That it, I say, it's a culmination of things that, I felt like a lot of campus protests just slowed down. You know? And it was the bombing that initiated it. Mm-hmm. I may be totally wrong, but it's just a feeling that I've always had around right around that time. So that, say, the 70-71 school year, I don't have any, you know, memories of things that I was at Viola still in Trip Hall. Rick and Jim Cousin, two of my friends who we just saw a couple times now, went to see Trainwreck. Anyway, had moved into an apartment on Lathrop Street over near Camp Randall, where I ended up the following year with them. The one thing I think that hit during 70-71 was because, okay, now what's happening? 1969, numbers were picked. 1970, for the second time, numbers were picked. They did it in August every year thereafter, where they were picking the numbers for the lottery. My number the next year would have been in the 300s, but that didn't count. In 1970, I remember that they went through the draft numbers and got into the 160s, which, of course, was my number 21. And right, you know, I was looking at being exposed to the draft. But during the 70-71 year is the time that the draft boards were calling everybody in. And probably particularly people with low numbers that were in college. They wanted to get stuff out of the way to see what kind of condition you were in, whatever. So I got called in for physical, and I actually, when you get on a bus in the morning, I'm coming out of Madison, it's dark, and I can't say when this was, December or January, possibly in that area, possibly later, whatever, but, you know, when, not during daylight savings time, I don't think. And then we come back in the dark. We go out there, you know, turn right and cough, do this. Okay, this is where the weight issue came into. At one point, I had hit the 240s or something like that. I think I'd already actually gone into government publications and found the stipulations about weight and height. You know, what was qualifying and what wasn't supposed to be qualifying. Of course, height, William Kelly, who you might have heard of, he was not tall enough. So, I mean, you could get around this stuff, you know, if you really want to get, yeah. But, you know, if you're 6'7", for example, or something like that, 6'8", whatever the heck it is, I mean, how can you hide yourself? See, that's kinds of things that you would have, that the Army, and understandably so, would have concerns about. So I think I looked at these charts and knew, but I'd lost some weight. So I came in at the 230s, but they took my height as 5'11", and there would be a difference even if they added a half an inch of bone at 6 feet. There would have been a difference. Well, another thing, my blood pressure was up then. It's up now too. And so I was disqualified. I would have been 1Y. In fact, there was 1Y. And I think I then on that basis, I think I took that. I believe I dropped my student deferment, my 1S, and took the 1Y deferment because, you know, am I going to be drafted? No. Okay. 9 months later, they asked me to get rechecked, or a year, whatever it is, whenever this occurred, and I'm still in at Madison, and I was like 250 at the time. I jumped up, and but the guys at the clinic, you know, the Madison clinic, were taking my height like 5'11 and a half. I said, don't give him that figure. I don't want him to think that I'm growing. Because, you know, they might think I might be draftable. I mean, the taller I get, the more I can weigh anyway, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I seem to remember that. But, so, this was around the time that within a few months, they eliminated 1Ys. And they were going to make them all 4Fs. But my board sends me a thing that I'm 1H. We know what 1H is. And, you know, I'm sorry, how come I'm 1H? You know, whatever. So, you know, I sent them some BS letter, and then they send me a BS letter back that says, well, your condition could change. You could, you could be tractable. But a 1H, of course, being, for example, if my number in 1969 had been 330 something, say, in 1970, I would be 170 down the line from the highest draft number, and I would have gone into the next priority. And then those people that had been picked in 1970 have to be picked first before I get picked. So, but, you know, 1H was as good as not being picked. And the numbers were already down. Even in the second year, I think they went in the 20s, you know, or 20s or 30s. It was low. So I wasn't concerned. So, you know, took my 1H deferment, and, you know, I was out. I knew I was out. And then sometimes after, I think I regret it. You know, friends that, well, I'm not sure that I had any friends that actually died in Vietnam, but, you know, friends that served, people that served. You know, I didn't serve. I didn't belong in the Army. I knew that much. I probably could have survived basic. You know, I don't think I could have handled that at all. So I was better off somehow accidentally getting out of it. But at the same time, as the years went along, I regretted it. I regretted it just simply because of what happened to people. Mm-hmm. What they had to go through.
Can I ask, can I ask one, maybe two more things? And I think we're going to shoot for like 40, 45 minutes again. So we're now into 70, 71, but I would like to ask what, if anything, you remember about I'll call them smaller bombings that the New Year's Gang did in early 1970. So the ROTC, the Primate Lab.
Oh, that stuff. I noticed that stuff on there. A lot of that I don't remember, you know, to tell you the truth. I say I remember activity, and I disremember, you know, I remember incorrectly what happened to the spud nuts or the timing of that. I just know things that were going on. But because I was becoming less involved, I think, you know, any specific memory is very indistinct about that kind of stuff.
Okay.
But at the same time, of course, the overall, especially that spring 69-70 semester, the 70 semester, you know, it's just the, with the combination of things that were going on, that semester was screwed. Like I said, you know, no finals or almost no finals.
So then when did you start to not only major in English, but then also you talk about secondary ed. When did that start to come?
Secondary ed, I think, finally started in in 70, 71.
Okay.
I think by then, or if it didn't start then, it was 71, 72. And I had to pick up the credits for it, the right credits, you know, the methods course, things like that. I thought about history as a minor, but then I would have had it done another methods course, and fooey, you know. I just thought, oh, okay, I got enough credits, I could have had a history minor. I mean, that was the only way I could actually have a minor, was to take a methods course. And the only, or at least as I understood it, the only way you couldn't get a minor in letters and science. You had to get it, you know, you could get a minor in ed. But you could only get that minor by going through the methods course, which was just another one methods course was enough. So. Mm-hmm.
So why decide to? I mean, I guess I assume if you're pursuing secondary ed, it means you're interested in teaching. So
I thought it was something I could do, but when I went through the whole process of it, went through the methods course because it did include the actual teaching. The methods course did not occur until my very last semester when I lived at Les Châteaux, just down the street from Memorial Union. It's called Phoenix now, as I understand it. Still there, right? Still pretty much looks like it, I guess, what it did. I was inside of it a few years ago, although I didn't get to. The president of the place took me around, but only, you know, not in any living areas. I kind of understand that. That's protective issue. I was ripped off there. We were very co-opish and open, so people would show up. But yeah, that semester I took my methods, and I got hemorrhoids. I was getting tension because I was doing something that actually ultimately had to conclude I wasn't very good at. I wasn't very good at leading a classroom. So, of course, with working in the State Historical Society Library then, and then going through that, it was sort of, okay, I'll become a librarian. So what do I do? Stupidly, of course, but this is all after my career here. I become a school librarian. And that was a mistake. I was a school librarian for 4 years. That should have been something else. I should have been a reference librarian. Well, lucky me. That's what I became eventually. Mm-hmm. By happenstance. You know.
Is there anything on your mind right now? I do want to do at least one more interview tomorrow just to make sure we catch everything. But is there something on your mind about, particularly this time period we talked about, which would be your third and your fourth year? So would that be 69 through 71, if you look at it that way, that you feel like you want to address?
I can't think of anything. I might come up with something later.
Okay.
Possibly.
Well, that's...
Overall stuff that I haven't talked about too much, but, you know, that's more personal stuff. It's like, I was not dating. I did not, you know, women and... It wasn't a matter of not, you know, I like women a lot, but just never had girlfriends throughout. Minor significant stuff, you know, that Sunday stuff where you go out, sometimes you would go out with somebody. There was like an editorial director or whatever on one of the channels in Milwaukee. His name was Roger LeGrand. I think 1 or 2 years, you know, you get the whole families together, they're showing up on commercials for news or whatever on TV, you know, and Kathy LeGrand was his eldest daughter or something, and she was going to college, she was going here, and in fact, she was a senior when I was a freshman, and I actually went out with one of those Sunday night meals with her, which was really kind of neat. It was neat to talk to her, but, you know, it's all, I remember this, I remember doing this, but, you know, there's no follow-up on my part. Well, hell, she's a senior for crying out loud. It's just, I can say something cool. I actually went out with Kathy LeGrand. Right. But, you know, I didn't have I had some girls, I think, eventually, that were like girlfriends, but it's not, you know, nothing significant happened until I was in grad school. Those are something I don't need to talk about here because it wasn't here.
That's right. Well, Bill, thank you for the time you gave me this afternoon. As I said, we'll probably do one more tomorrow just to make sure we say what we need to say.
Yeah, so thank you very much for your time. At least about the co-op. So.
Okay, good. Okay, we're going to start this. So this is September 1st, 2015. This is the, we're going to call it the second oral history session, although this is sort of our third recording, with Bill Provis, and I'm Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program.
You're still Troy Reeves.
I am, every time. Bill, would you spell your last name to help with the sound quality?
P-R-O-V-I-S.
Great. So we last left... It was sort of the end of your college, but we really didn't, I don't think, get to the last year, the last semester very well.
I suppose we could do that and then jump back to some of my overall things that I want to...
Yeah, let's do that. So let's start with, I think there was something you wanted to say about the co-op. There was an incident.
The co-op, okay. The co-op had a president. The co-op had already existed at least for a few years. In fact, according to some... minor history, and I haven't talked to the Madison Community Co-op, which I need to do, see if they have any records that they've ever maintained. But anyway, so it probably was a co-op from the late 60s, you know, one of these buildings that had originally, of course, been a fraternity, sorority, whatever. So a friend of mine, who I actually saw a picture of recently, or a group picture that one of my friends that I connected up with is took over at the Union South, was supposed to be my roommate for this one semester and at the co-op, and he ended up doing something else, like dropping out, whatever, for temporarily and doing something else, so ended up with a different roommate, a guy who I think had come from Stanford and I thought was older, but I'm not sure if I've ever run across his name yet. It bothers me, but maybe it was different than I thought. You know, memory is always not good, or often not good. But the co-op was designed. I had to take care of the next semester. I was going to graduate, you know, and I had to be sure that there was going to be somebody there. Well, that was relatively easy. That was of some concern to me, you know, because it was only I wasn't going to be there the whole year. I was, you know, going to be done. I didn't want to be paying for another semester. I wasn't going to be at, you know, right? But there was like, I think there was a list or something for the place, you know, people, because it was relatively cheap, I guess, in comparison to the dorms, your meals taken care of, you were responsible for cleanup and making meals on certain days. We actually paid someone to make a lot of our meals to put them together. And we were responsible, though, for being sure that they got doled out properly, which I failed to do. I remember one of the guys going, "Hey, there's not enough meatloaf here for everybody. What's going on? How come? You know, we paid for all, you know, because I paid, you know, it was, you know, you can't always depend on people showing up, and then here you go. Here I am eating seconds, and oh my God. Bad person. So, that's some general view of the co-op. Telephones, which, see, in my research, which is related to stuff we'll probably talk about later, as I remember, they had little locks on them, these little, you know, dial phones with little locks on them or something, which we had keys for, but that was to prevent other people from using the phones, that is, foreigners, I guess. And I seem to remember there was only like two of them, but what I keep running across, what I've run across for numbers related to residents of Les Châteaux, which in the directory is just listed as 636 Langdon, I think I've run across four or five different numbers, 251 exchange numbers, which, you know, was interesting, but some other phones, maybe it was more than two. Memory. The main floor had a, you know, like a den, something. I don't think we had a TV or anything in it, but people would gather there or whatever. And on what I did do some other research on, and it was September the 8th, 1972, I was sitting there in the in that Danish area on the first floor, and I felt a rumble or a vibration in the building, and was like, oh, you know, one of those things, oh, a truck's going by or something like that. But there wasn't any truck going by, and it was more of a vibration than what you would normally think of as a truck going by. Some time later, while I was sitting there, I think I was sitting or whatever I was doing, the House President, and I believe correctly his last name is Schmidt, his first name was Phil, anyway, that's the only Philip I found in my research, so I'm pretty sure that's who it was. He was living, or staying, whatever, in a room way up, if you've ever seen this building, up like in the turret. Mm. And I guess he was napping, sleeping, or whatever. And he came down, and he was asking, did you feel that? Because, you know, he felt it up there. And I have a feeling it was much more serious. And, of course, as it turns out, it was no truck. It was an earthquake. And it was the most serious earthquake, and I think there have been some since then. But, you know, coming out of the St. Louis area, I guess, basically, or, you know, Missouri area, and it reached I think it might have reached a scale in the 3s, 4s, something like that, but enough, you know, so here it is, I'm sitting, you know, it's an earthquake, it just, wow, weird, and I know it was a few years ago that I was doing research on that, and finally ran across the date, you know, and, well, that works, but I didn't realize, well, September the 8th, that would have been, geez, like, early on in the semester yet, but it had to be that date. So you know, that was kind of significant. Beyond that, I can't remember too much about life in the co-op. Although I developed a really good friend who now hates me, or you know, whatever is. Been irritated with me since 2001 over an issue that she should be, you know, it's like, okay, I don't know, it has something to do with people that live in California, I think, but it's just related to, I couldn't keep her up at in Chicago where I was living, or where I still live, and, you know, a few years before, of course, she'd consistently been inviting me to San Francisco, well, San Rafael, where she lived at the time, and I finally went in 96, you know, and I think, I regrettably think, I probably took some advantage of her, but I thought I'd try to keep myself out of the way, but, you know, she got irritated because, you know, I had conflicts, I just, you know, I'm one of these people that was, I'm kind of like inward, and I can't just say no, or I can't, you know, I have to mamby-pamby around or something. It can't be straightforward. But there were issues and, you know, whatever. And she got mad, and as it turns out, I was in San Francisco for convention. And I actually talked to her on the phone. We'd sort of been in contact through Facebook, which she initiated. But then she jumped on me about this thing from 2001, and it's like, oh man. And then I'm much more firm in explaining, not verbally, but writing it on our Facebook messages. Okay, these were the issues. I didn't tell you all of them. And it doesn't make any difference. She's irritated. I'm disappointed because we were really good friends. We used to make fun of people in the co-op and stuff like that. It was one of those things. And, you know, somebody that you talked to, one of the best friends I had for a long period of time from that call, one that I had kept in touch with at least periodically. And we went to a wedding of two of the co-op members that was just, you know, after that, my last semester while I was living at home with my parents before I started grad school. the following fall. Mm-hmm. It was a wedding, I think, in Sheboygan. It was a wedding of the person who handled a lot of the main kitchen duties, I think, and somebody else. I think I know the guy's name. I think it was Dean Rudolph that was the guy, but the girl, I'm not sure. It might have been Sue Holler. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But okay. I'm not sure. You know, okay. I'm not sure the name. I'm not sure I've gotten all those names. That's one of those things I keep looking.
Sure.
So that's sort of a summary of that, you know, life. And at the that was during a period, too, where I was beginning to drop my weight and heading into, you know, the 220s and below instead of weighing so much because, well, I was safely out of the draft as far as I was concerned.
So I know there are some things that you want to sort of touch on, and we both have, I think, some ending things we want to touch on. But the other thing I told you I was going to ask you about was any instructors that might stand out.
Yes.
You had mentioned that it never was a big deal, but I wonder if
I mean, during the time, you see, you're hitting, you know, when you talk to people like us, I suppose, you know, we're already reaching, of course, those memory issues. And I'm sure that there are people, actually, the guy who hit, and I don't know that, I'm not sure that I have the professor's name for Major American Poets, the guy who hit was the only final that I had that spring semester 69-70, but he was pretty good. He was in his 70s, I think. But I'm not sure that I have his name anywhere in on materials that I still save. Let me double check.
But he seems to be the only one, really.
He's the one that kind of stands out. Well, I had a professor who gave us an assignment. And I, in one of my history classes, that was like, okay, here's your assignment, or your, maybe it was our final or something, or whatever it is. But we were supposed to take a whole bunch of names during our historical period that we were working on. And, you know, I don't remember which history class this is, to tell you the truth. And we were supposed to write a letter between two of these people. You know, why would one I remember distinctly working on was I think it was it was a circus related name. I'm thinking it was Barnum. Mm. And he was writing to I can't remember. It was something I was able to kind of like connect a reason to do it. You know, it was kind of a fun assignment, but unfortunately I don't remember that professor's name or which course it was in. And it might have been the course where I determined that I must have glasses. Things were getting a little bit fuzzy from some distance.
Mm-hmm. So even though you don't know their names, there are some
things that that stand out, mm-hmm, about it, or that I remember, but I don't remember names, and not single six. My comp course for and I do remember at least one professor that I can get to, but my comp course, I don't remember what her name was. That my comp course, that is not the freshman comp course, the comp course for me being going on as secondary ed in English, was instructive, difficult, but, you know, it worked out pretty good, and I thought she was pretty good. I think she had to cut our final, which was good for me, because I got to see Woody Allen's Bananas and go off and have pizza over at Pino's, you know, with my buddies, which would have been difficult if I had the extra half hour in the final. Professor Reed, I think I had following her, in a semester following her anyway, where I did a paper on the talking chimps, which I had very general criticism of the talking chimps, and Professor Reed, and he was enjoyable and instructive. But what it's the history of the English language, would supposedly, but what it's become is a study of generative grammar. And the reason the whole thing appealed to me then is because the English language was being put into a mathematical structure. Basically, through the concept of generative grammar, you have a finite number of phrases and clauses and things, and you know, and you have a finite number of sentence structures that you can have. You have an infinite vocabulary, infinite dictionary, say, an infinite lexicon, but you have certain structures that are finite, as even as much as they could be extensive. So, you know, what generative grammar was like, the mathematical concept of what we used to do with sentence diagramming in kids, that when we were kids in grammar school. But it put a mathematical flavor to things, and that appealed to me. Why, of course, because I was interested in math, of course, as we talked about earlier. And, of course, it leads to my interest in computers, which it's like, oh my God, there's just so much about computers we can't know. There's too much. But anyway. So he was somewhat influential, I think, from the standpoint of English language structure that interested me. But it's not something that necessarily carried on.
Okay.
In, you know, later years. It's just that it was an application issue, or dealing with structure and math. That stuff had started before I got to college, but then continued on, I think, throughout my career, my interest in having some form of structure in relationship to things that I was doing.
Okay. So that's, I mean, there's some other things I want to ask, but I think now you have some things that either reflected upon.
Okay. Reflecting on, I realized I was born and raised in Chicago, but, you know, Chicago's an excluded city. That is, it's neighborhoods, right? It's communities, and these communities and neighborhoods are still significantly divided racially. Maybe not so much I would like to say certainly not as much as it was when I was a kid in Chicago. But still, there's that element. 60th in Yale. I was at 121st Elizabeth in the last, like, 6-7 years that we lived in Chicago. And that's the West Pullman area, way south in Chicago. You hear about 60th and Yale as being like a dangerous area, African Americans and stuff like that. So I didn't know so many, actually. Though throughout my school years, there was maybe one African American in our West Pullman that I kind of, you know, remember, but, you know, wasn't in my classes or anything, was younger. And, you know, otherwise, no. College become, we moved to Wisconsin, Port Washington, Wisconsin. There are African Americans in the area now, but not many, but there weren't, of course, any then. And so I get to know some people then, and some, well, one from Chicago area, Bob Ritchie, who I remember, he grabbed one of these, he had a hypodermic syringe that had nothing in it. I'm going to inject you with this. You know, it's chasing me around all the places. One of those things. But I was told later, actually, you couldn't really kill somebody with it, you know, by injecting them with the air. I'm not so sure, but you know, what can I say? But Carl McDowell is the one that I remember. He was an African-American with a nature that was kind of like, he wasn't a revolutionary type. Bob Ritchie would move more in that area, I think. Although I'm not sure, because I did follow up on him after my first couple of years in Og, and I think he was there the second year. But Carl, I came, I think, decent buddies with, but he was much older. I also remember doing stupid things like, okay, we're at Gordon Commons, we're sitting around, it's near Christmas time, Carl's at the table, and I start singing, I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. And, you know, it was purposely to, like, be funny about it. You know, the concept of white Christmas, whatever. But it's also to make fun of these kinds of racial issues, I think. I would sometimes say some extraordinarily obtuse sort of racial things because I was trying to undercut the whole concept of race and the divisions of race. And I was making fun of it. You know? And if people knew me, then they understood I wasn't really saying anything offensive at all. I was saying something that was really supposed to be anti-offensive. Things that developed back then. And, of course, related to why I was more of a participant, I think, during the Black Studies March. I thought there was something about the general history, but I think of it afterwards, probably. People, I don't know. Do you want some names now? Is it okay?
Sure.
When I went to Vilas, my first roommate the first semester that I was in Vilas, the spring 69-70 semester, was Tom Ducharme. I don't know if he's around. He was dating Lynn Abramson, who I'm sure is Dr. or Professor Lynn Abramson with psychology department here, of course. And if you haven't talked to her, maybe she is worthwhile talking to. I don't know if she must have talked to me at all. I actually dated one of her roommates. I had called her a few years ago. I was trying to make, you know, a gentle approach. Okay, you know, it's been, yeah, I was Tom's roommate, but she didn't call back. I left a message, I think, on her office machine or something, and maybe at her home, too. And I've stopped a couple of times, but she's never been in her office at the time that I'm there. I just, you know, I'm reluctant to pursue it diligently, but every once in a while I might stop over there. I don't imagine she's thinking of retirement necessarily, but she is 65. But, you know, there's a possible source of oral history. She is with this group, then the Vilas group that, you know, I'm closest to, our freshman in 68-69. Jim Cousin and Rick Rosen are the two big ones and guys that I've reconnected with more recently. It shouldn't have been that long. But they started out at Vilas in 68-69. I've researched that year. Of course, that's all part of what we'll get into as we move along here. I guess, you know, I've hit just about everything that I can think of now.
Okay.
Chances are I may come up with something later.
Right.
You know.
So, I guess my conclusion, or it's not necessarily a concluding question. Oh, no, I do have one more thing. You brought up Chicago, and I had this listed to talk to you. Do you have any memories, whether you were actually there or not, of the 68 Democratic Convention in Chicago?
No, I wasn't there, of course. We left Chicago in 63, but yeah, definitely I have memories related to it because they were significant to the areas of Wisconsin because of what happened there in 68. And because we had certain negative feelings about Richard J. Daley, and good old Richard, he would stick his foot in his mouth sometimes while he's talking, sort of like what other people, Donald Trump. But people like Donald Trump. Well, of course, they elected Richard J. Daley for years, so what can I say? For a Donald Trump gets elected, oh, no pain. But yeah, it what happened, of course, in 68. And what followed with Nixon being president, you know, It's funny, too, Nixon being president, he got to be president by, you know, this, you know, whatever. Hubert Humphrey actually came, he was a week away from possibly being elected, basically. Hubert, of course, was not looked at with fondness because of his connections with Johnson. Johnson selected him to be vice president, you know, that kind of thing. Of course, I guess at the time when Johnson became president after the assassination, we didn't have a vice president until the election, or, well, until the inauguration after the election we didn't have. So Hubert had the connections then to those things that we blame Johnson for, Vietnam, the expansion in Vietnam, you know, stuff like that. So this kind of stuff, he was about a week away. Kennedy would have won, we believe, and I think anybody historically had to believe that Robert Kennedy would have won. The assassination was just totally screwed up, any concept of any Democrat. We just didn't have the right guys. Eugene McCarthy was very anti-war. My brother ended up working for him some years later, and that sort of undercut some of the things going on with Humphrey in 68. You know, there are a variety of issues. Of course, Edward was not ready, and then when he would have been ready, he screwed up his life. And he couldn't seriously run for president. Unfortunately, because of Chappaquiddick, largely, it just wasn't going to work. Mm-hmm. You know, if that hadn't happened, his year to run really would have been like 72, and it might have worked, but the Chappaquiddick thing was too much there already. You know, so that all relates to, you know, what did those violent, semi-violent, non-violent, whatever things do in 68, what happened at that convention, what made it difficult to have a convention again in Chicago. You had to make sure you had the right logistics and control, you know, that kind of stuff, and not a lot of the stupidity that occurred amongst the police in relationship to these demonstrators. Chicago wasn't really prepared for that, and that's what caused, I think, a lot of campus unrest after that, was what happened during it. You know, and I suppose, looking backwards, it's very understandable that they weren't prepared. And it's not, we can't misunderstand how police reacted and like that. That's understandable, too. It's just the way things are. It's just we have to accept they shouldn't have reacted that way. But they weren't in a position of knowledge and understanding of what they were looking at that would have, you know, made this a much more peaceful issue. And of course, you know, there were undercurrents of issues, 66 housing strike and Martin Luther King Jr. coming to Chicago and, you know, stuff like that, that are all kind of related, I think, to what happens, even though it's a lot of people. We can blame those outside agitators, you know. Mm-hmm. We can always blame those outside agitators. Oh, SDS, they're all outside agitators. On this campus, they weren't. Mm-hmm. There were a lot inside agitators. There were a lot of people that I think were from here. Mm-hmm. That helped to found SDS.
So my final question or questions that might arise from the question is, you know, I've got to know you because you've come back here to our archives to do research in the time period. So my first question is...
Why did this happen?
Yeah, why?
Okay, so there's the history to this, of course. The history relates to my last semester at Og. My last semester at Og, right at the beginning, there were, I thought there were two women, girls, whatever, up in our den, and they were asking questions about, or a question about, okay, what happened to this particular resident, whose name I will just leave out. And I knew nothing, but I remember seeing them on, like, my last day in the dorms previous semester. I thought he was a freshman. Technically, he was a freshman. But actually, he started in 67, 68, and he was variously flunking courses, you know, and I didn't realize this. But anyway, one of them, I thought both of them were sisters, but one of them for sure was a sister in any case. And I thought there were two. You know, that was my memory. And that was something that always stuck with me. But it's something I never pursued. So this is Ag Hall, right? What happens in the mid-aughts or mid to late aughts? The announcement that Ag Hall is being torn down. Okay. I freak out. I have to do a quick aside. Ag Hall is new. In fact, it's newer than any of the dorms that exist at the time that I started. It's the newest of the dorms. Witte and Celery, all these guys that are still there, they're still there, you know, but they were older. They were relatively new, but, you know, I was 65. While I was on campus, the Union South was built 69, whatever. And here we go. The two newest buildings, one while I was there even, are gone. Like, yeah, okay. A friend of mine, you know, everything was wrong about the Union South. It just wasn't, you know, whatever. And then, of course, those things that I found historically afterwards, that Ag was considered, like say, a slum or something, you know, something just a high-rise mistake. One of the funny things I remember about Ag, to throw in another thing, get on the elevator, all right? Sometimes all the buttons were pushed. You know, see, you're typical. Oh, we got kids screwing up. Okay, if you keep that door open, take the floor that you're on floor 9, say. Hold down the floor 9 button, press the other button, press another button. You could erase the buttons that were pressed. That's the only place I know of where you could do something like that, you know, but it's something, you know, see, somebody learns this and it gets passed on to other people. It's just little details, so whatever. So anyway, where was I? Okay, so Ag, right? So it was that thing that bothered me. And then Ag was being torn down. My brother, I believe it was my brother, who told me about something. They were trying to collect stories. And this was one that really stuck with me, but I couldn't really write it. You know, I couldn't come up with something. And then, of course, from that time on, I always thought, where are these stories? Right? And just recently, finally, I found what the thing must have been, because I thought it was, you know, the dormitory organization itself, the residence halls organization, administration or whatever that was collecting it. For sure, they weren't. It was the University of Wisconsin Foundation. They did an Ag block. Abe, you know, Abe who answers questions, right? I've never found, why did I just find this now, or, you know, just within the last couple of weeks? Abe had, like, two references in answering questions to, okay, look at the Ag block. Well, these were older answers to questions. Look at the Ag block. Some Madison, hostmadison.com or something like that, I ran across that too. A reference to the Ag block. Okay, wait, I can't find the Ag block. You know, it's one of those things that probably doesn't exist. I sent a question to the foundation, and I got an answer. Well, can't seem to get anything on this. I'll do some more. My feeling is that it's gone, you know, right? Okay. You know, and like none of these guys. Abe didn't give a link. Host Madison didn't give a link. You know, at least if I could hit the link, I could find out that it was dead. But I'd be fascinated in, you know, the series of stories. I mean, I'm passing stories on to you that I might have been able to throw into that blog, and I just, you know, the blog is gone. It just doesn't have any. Hey, you know, I thought you could get everything. Well, you could still go into, I guess, what was it? There's that internet history site, you know, mm-hmm. where past what the web was like whenever. Maybe I could find it that way. I don't know. But I just thought of it. Okay. All this just kind of, that period anyway, that odd blog, I guess, that is what we're talking about, that was being created, all created at that time, at the time of the end of initiated my thoughts on this, but I wasn't retired. Okay. In 2010, then finally, see, I've gone through a whole long period where I haven't been on campus. In fact, I hadn't been in Madison from 1980 until 2006, I think this was, when I came to Madison and moved my brother back home, or back to Port Washington, where he lives now, where he took care of my dad in his last few years for his, you know, Alzheimer's. So that was the first time I'd been in Madison at that time. My brother was always saying, oh, come on, you gotta go to a game and stuff like that. You know, all right. My life became one where Saturdays were all occupied with work, largely. You know, I just couldn't think about stuff like that. Then I could barely get a chance to watch the band just because I'm working on Saturdays and the game's on Saturday. Even if it's on TV, I can't see. So I retired in 2009. And by then, I could barely miss a Badger game because, you know, we got Big Ten Network and all this kind of stuff. I can start doing something. So I finally get to a game then with this group that my brother had been with and continued on the Sultorally through about 2011, and it just kind of broke up, became too fragmented, and which one of my dorm mates from Vilas was actually in, and he didn't know it. He didn't know Tim was my brother. And, you know, it was a freaky sort of thing. We found this out later. But anyway, so 2010, I come back to the campus to go. And I was looking around. I went into the Wisconsin State Historical Society. I haven't been in there since then, but the first time I've been there since leaving Madison as a student, I think, or maybe not, but near that in any case. And looking at the Red Gym and taking pictures of that, you know, stuff like that, things that had some element of meaning as to campus-related things. Of course, the Memorial Union is always... Now, what is the Memorial Union? It's a thing that always seems to be obscured by construct. Anyway. So, I'm back. And it was the Indiana game that year, which you then may remember was the Indiana Slaughter. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, we've had a number of Indiana Slaughters in recent years, but nothing like that. That was, like, extraordinary. I remember we were at Lucky's, and Boise State, of course, would consistently seem to be beating somebody, which they do on a Friday night, 50 to something. I kept saying, I want to outscore Boise, who just scored 55 points, I think, the night before. And these guys are thinking 80 points well before that it ever struck me that we could be there. Anyway, it was a fascinating thing, and that brought me back. Around that time, I tried to contact my friend Rick Rosen, I mentioned, was elegant, like my best friend. And I didn't realize there was a problem with contacting him. I had a number, and I never got an answer. And then ultimately, the next year, finally, or something, we found out, I'd been calling a number that he wasn't using, that he turned over to one of his kids. And he'd never gotten information that I tried to get in contact with him. I was kind of irritated with, hey, you know, whatever. And then finally we connected up, at least for the first time physically, since the actual last time, you know, with any length that I talked to him was 1977, at the Michigan State game where, who's our quarterback? Josh. I would say Josh is. The guy. Stave. That's it. Stave got injured for the first time. And because of that, unfortunately, we lost that homecoming game. That was the 2012, you know, the year after Russ. Russell, which I went to a couple of games. So I used to, I got connected, I'm going to Badger games. That's it. One thing I missed from my first year, the only year that I went to Badger games, because then after that, working at the Historical Society Library and in microfilm, I was ended up doing a lot of Saturdays, so I just couldn't, you know, get the games. That year, Johnny Cota, right after Milt Brune, you know, retires, I guess, Johnny Cota's first year, and Playboy picks Wisconsin to be 7-3. My freshman year, 67, 68, 67, fall 67. What's the team? 0-10-1 or 0-9-1? 0-9-1. Yeah, we only did 10 games then, I think. And the futility of it all was an Iowa State or an Iowa game where John Boyage and the quarterback passes into the end zone. It hits one of our guys in the back, bounces up, and a defender intercepts in the end zone. That was like an incident. But that was the tie. I got to see two physical ties, you know, the year before for Parents Day in Camp Randall. So, you know, that's my memory of that. But, yeah, games, that brought me back. Wisconsin had become something. Barry came, you know, and you see at the beginning of this still now with the Jumbotron, that thing that's like the history from the time before, where, you know, when guys like Alan Amici were around, but then when Barry comes. Well, you better get your tickets now, right? You know, stuff like that, and it makes me kind of cry because I just, like, we didn't have good teams. Mm-hmm. Which, somebody did a thesis about this, and it wasn't Wisconsin related or whatever. Campus unrest was related to how bad your football team was. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so, you know, they brought me back, and then that related to connections. And of course, Jim Cousin, and Rick Rose lives up in Fitchburg, and Jim Cousin is on the other side of the lake over here, I think. Was of course a good buddy. He lived in the apartment, you know, with Rick the year before I came into the apartment with him, and of course then during that year, and of course I knew him from Viola's house. You know, all the guys were at Viola's that first semester that I was there in the spring 69-70. So, you know, there you go. So that now we're connected up, and I've gone beyond the misunderstanding, and these guys still mean a lot to me, and we remark on it, they remark on it, and they have had far more connections with a lot of the guys that. But then they knew a lot of these guys longer than I did, too, because, you know, I came to Viola's Crusade. That was their sophomore year, and then they jumped off to the apartment, you know. So I was kept connected with them. They had parties and things like that. And, of course, the day that I went for the draft physical, when I got back, still dark in Madison, you know, leave in the dark, come back in the dark, whatever. But I went off to the apartment to, and I was talking with Rick, you know, about just about, I think, the issues of the draft and stuff like that. And, these guys were significant to me then, and they still are now. But, you know, it's a whole group of guys that were kind of significant to each other, which is, it's nice to see. I'm not connected up so much with some of these other guys, and hopefully I might get a chance to see some of them because I knew them. But at some time or another. One couple who were a couple back then, Dave and Vicky. Anyway, I last seen in Milwaukee when I was in graduate school in 73 or something, and they come and visit Rick a lot, and I actually saw them, I think, last year at the Minnesota game, and before the Ohio State disaster. Anyway, it's just nice to reconnect. Mm-hmm. How did I have? I did know that Rick was around. The reason that I would contact with Rick, you were at, mentioning social media. I had done a search, I think, an internet search, and I ran into Rick existing, on Facebook. I wasn't on Facebook, but then I joined up. That's part of the reason I joined up with Facebook. Actually, I despise social media. I will not get on Twitter. You know, as much as, you know, I want to see what some people are, you know, I can't connect up with these people that are doing some kind of talking or whatever related to Twitter and stuff like that unless I'm on Twitter, but I won't do it. The Maryland game last year, we were sitting underneath the upper deck, you know, where the press box is, and where they have a whole bunch of TVs now, of course, TVs, right? Well, the one more directly in front of us wasn't working. And, you know, my brother says, we got to tell these people, they got to do some, you know, whatever. He says, and he says, well, you know, get on Twitter. I said, well, I don't have an account. And, you know, and I was kind of like working on it, but I ultimately said, I don't want to do this because I don't want a Twitter account. I don't want to, you know, and let administration or whatever know anything through Twitter. Fooey. They fixed it, though, of course. But, you know, it would have been nice that it was running and some of the other. But who cares? You want to see what's out there in the field for granted. So, yeah, I'm not happy with the concept of social media. I am in LinkedIn, too, but I don't do anything particularly active with it. I refuse to do all these upgrades. Oh, pay money and do this. You know, it's just like classmates.com. One place where I think where I was first, you know, running into a place where you could search up maybe your mates from Port Washington. That's a social media type of thing. But, you know, they always say, oh, if you want to see who looked at your profile and who did this, okay, get this particular subscription. And I say, why do I have to spend money on it? And so not that it's that much money, but yeah, LinkedIn is like that too. But LinkedIn I got into as it related to, okay, trying to find this person. So that's what brought me back here. Initially then, after the 2010 visit in 2011, I said, when Union South was first opening that summer, the new Union South, I said, remember, oh, come on, you know, birthday present, we'll go and stay in Madison, I can do some research, you know, whatever. And so I had this guy's first name. I knew his first name. So, I was coming, and finally I was going to do something. I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but I had his first name, so I knew what my approach would be. And before I came, of course, I've been using the computer catalog and saying, okay, what can I look at? And, of course, I'd run across the residence halls directories, which are only here, as one of the first things that I did want to see, which I figured would be easier. I didn't remember those directories. My brother does. Remember that these things existed, and it was among the first places then. And of course, I think I initiated my research here, and you know, of course, talked to David, and David was bringing out stuff for me, and those directories which I needed to initially research, the 67-68 directory, that's the staff student one, which least I could look at over at Memorial, you know, because it's painful to look at those things, you know, because there's so many names. But I needed verification. So I had the guy's first name, and the first person that I run into, and my brother's with me, just happens to be with me here when I initiated the research, so he was helping out a little bit. I said, okay, take a look. I found him in the dorm directory for 60. I was working at 68-69. That was my initial, because I knew he existed there. Okay, and that's the last he existed. Then we're talking about the fall 69-70 when his sister showed up. Okay, the first one with the first name that I'm finding. I said, okay, Tim, why don't you take a look at the, because I noted that the extensive directories included home addresses, because I looked myself up in it. And, oh, well, there's the address of Washington. So I thought that was kind of cool. So he looks up. I said, see if he has a sister. He said, oh, yeah, hey, that's a good idea. My brother, the lawyer. But, you know, I'm a librarian, okay? We're detectives, aren't we? So he looks it up, and there was a sister. Ultimately, the first one was the one. And eventually, but after going through the whole deal and putting together, you know, the whole floor and everything and getting pretty much everybody there, he was the one, and I actually eventually talked to him. And pretty much then confirmed, you know, yeah, okay, he had to be the one. He believed that his sister would have come the next year and what had happened because of his various, you know, not passing courses and stuff like that. He kind of, like, he jumped off with an uncle or something and went to work for him, I think, something like that, and he didn't tell anybody. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, there you go. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, I was always worried, you know, because over the years, it got bothered me more, because we're looking at the milk carton syndrome, you know, that kind of stuff. And, you know, I think, missing person, you know, what happened to him? And here, amazingly enough, that I was able actually to track him down. So then that initiated, all right, I kind of want to look at all the names, everybody. I want to look at all my years that I was here, you know. And, of course, I included in my research the freshman year of Violas for Rick and Jim, which I had no direct connection with, but I thought that would be useful to research. So I've got these names, but I just feel like certain things haven't been found. A significant thing that occurred, I thought, when I was a freshman was The Graduate first came to theaters, and it was playing out at the Atwood, which I guess still exists in some form. There were lines for that were going out, you know, blocked down the street and around a corner, you know, stuff like that. Because, of course, it's a big Atwood. It was a big theater. It's like the Orpheum, like, well, the old Capitol, which is going, you know, they're pretty big, right? You can have a lot of people standing around. I mean, these things don't exist anymore. It's the Point Cinema 12, you know, mm-hmm. stuff like that. So the roommate of a guy around the corner, I was in a corner in my 907 AG looking across towards Celery, and the room kind of behind and, you know, around the corner in the hallway, which would have been, I want to say it's 906, but I can't say, yeah, it would have been 906, pretty sure, yeah. Joe Forager, I got to know. His roommate was from Liberia, and it was that guy who was telling me the story of this film, The Graduate, which wasn't exactly, but it was. It just kind of interested me the way he was describing it. So I went to the film. I went that the next week. 2 months later, I went again. A few years later, I saw it at the Capitol, I think, not at the Orpheum. And then a few years after that, out at Westown. We sat through it twice, you know, when you could still do this kind of thing and nobody would chase you out. Where I saw Ben Murphy's Blue Eyes. Anyway, and real, you know, it's like historically certain things occur, people you know at some point or know of or whatever at some point or another you don't recognize. And then all of a sudden you recognize them right in front of you. He was in the shower scene. Save us a piece of the cake. Always remember that. That's still a big film to me. I don't understand why the Criterion Collection hasn't been able to take its Laserdisc version of it and put it into Blu-ray, because it was a tremendous version that they did. The commentary, the guy who did the commentary, was very interesting.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I think that wraps it up. Unless there's something else about your time here.
Yeah, I think I hit some of the things that I was thinking about that I was missing. So.
Okay, good. All right, well, this concludes the oral history with Bill Provost. So, Bill, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.